Hey everyone, before we start, I just wanted to remind you that this episode will be a continuation of the discussion we've been having on Richard Wolff's Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism, and on workplace democracies more generally. And in particular, we'll be talking about the broader political and economic impacts of workplace democracy. And as always, we thank you for listening and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day.
All right, so we've gestured at all of these sort of positive aspects of workplace democracy and why, on balance, they could be better than the current capitalist arrangement with respect to a number of different dimensions. Now, an obvious question here, I mean, because people might be wondering, like, okay, these are so great. Why have we not really heard of these before? Why is this new? Why are there not many of these? And so an obvious concern is, like, can they compete? Can they work? Can they compete with the capitalist institutions? After all, you know, there's a whole field which is dedicated to showing you how efficient the capitalist organization is. And if that's right, then how are these things going to survive? So, you know, maybe what we can start with is discussion of productivity, right? I mean, because one concern you might have is like, look, if workers aren't, I mean, right, here's a really flat-footed, cynical concern that, you know, maybe, you know, some of our family members might have. Before you look into these things, you're like, if you put the workers in charge, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to cut all, you know, they're going to cut their hours and they're going to pay themselves more and they're, you know, something like that, right? They'll basically decrease their own productivity and reward themselves. And if productivity decreases, then they're going to have a hard time competing with other businesses and they'll fail. And maybe that explains why there aren't that many of them around. But so maybe the place to start is to just talk about some of the research that's done on productivity in workplace democracies.
Yeah, I think there's really, we need to separate those two questions of the question of productivity and the question of why there aren't more of these kinds of organizations around, right? Because the productivity question, it could be, well, they are more productive, and in some ways that's what we're going to say, right? Whereas in terms of why there aren't more of these places around, well, it could be that there's just a lot of artificial barriers to entry, right, that are independent of the question of productivity.
Yep.
And I think at the end of the day, a full explanation of why there are so few such enterprises when they are highly productive have to do with those barriers
to entry. Okay, good. So let's start with the productivity. Are workplace democracies as productive as their capitalist counterparts on balance? Are they more productive? And then afterwards, we can ask, well, if they are as productive, why aren't there that many of them? But let's start with the productivity.
You can quickly Google this. And what you're going to find is the same sort of response provided over and over again, which if you, I actually went through the lectures from the University of Edinburgh on workplace democracies and worker cooperatives. And what they say is what I've read over and over, which is, as far as they can tell, for the most part, these organizations are at least as productive as their capitalist counterparts, if not more so. And this is surprising, given the concerns you raise. And I think that there are other concerns in the ballpark that are somewhat less cynical, which Wolf engages with a bit more, right? Which is like, well, how about the adoption of technological advancement, which would lead to redundancy of workers, right? Like, the non-cynical reason, I think, to be concerned about worker cooperatives being less productive in the long run has to do with the potential for slower pace of adoption of technologies that would render those very workers unnecessary, right?
So before we get to that concern, though, why don't we say a little bit more, because it might be surprising. Why is it that they can be as productive or more productive?
So it might be surprising that worker cooperatives are more productive, or at least as productive as their capitalist counterparts. But there are some obvious psychological explanations for why that might be the case. went in the University of Edinburgh class, they interview various people who work at worker cooperatives. And one of the things that they say is that because they have ownership over the company, right, that they are really invested in the company's productivity and profitability and its long-term health, they really take on responsibility for the overall performance of the company and really care that the company performs well, right? There's obvious incentives in place for workers to care, right? And partly it just comes from the fact that the more autonomy you grant people and the more people are just going to be invested in something. But it is also the case that it really is, there's a direct correlation between how the company does and how they personally
They're stakeholders in a more direct way now. But then, as you also note, there's an obvious impact on morale because of the increased autonomy, as we said. And that obviously can have beneficial effects on your worker productivity as well. One of the other big things, and actually there's a report to the UK Labour Party that was published a couple years ago, I think, on alternative models of ownership, and they talk about cooperatives at length. And they recommend them over the typical private model precisely, at least in part, because of the ways in which the private model actually limits productivity. In particular, and this is something I think you raised earlier, in the private model, where you're trying to maximize profit, you're doing it, much of what you produce is going towards the shareholders, right, in the form of dividends, or in some cases, it's going to go to stock buybacks, whatever else. These are non-productive ways to spend your money. In a workplace democracy, where you're not going to have those separate shareholders in the first place, you'll be freed up to reinvest in things that actually, in growing your enterprise, right, and things that actually promote the productivity of it.
So I have a little worry about the use of some of this evidence. This is like a pure philosophical. This is the armchair speculation about empirical matters. You know, the best kind of philosophy. But one of the things that I do worry about a little bit is you have this evidence that these worker co-ops are more productive. You also have this evidence that they can afford to pay higher wages, and that a lot of people are moving over to these worker co-ops precisely because they actually see wage gains from doing so. And in most industries, even if you're not talking about, you know, you're not doing a comparison between worker co-ops and capitalist organizations, you nevertheless will expect that if one company is paying significantly more than another company, that one company is going to be attracting better talent, right? That they're going to actually attract more productive workers. And I do wonder how much that relates to the data that's available about the extra productivity of these organizations. You know, and then this is just a kind of like, we do capitalism better kind of argument again. But there's obviously a lot of caveats and a lot of complexity in trying to evaluate the data that's available. The other thing that I'm a bit concerned about is, you know, Wolf identifies this really common concern that people have with worker co-ops, which is that generally capitalist societies see major growth in productivity from technological adoption that ultimately displaces workers and renders them redundant. Right. And there's a natural concern that if workers are the ones who are making the decisions as to whether they should adopt some technology that's ultimately going to render them unnecessary, would they be inclined to do so? Right. And if there's disincentive for that kind of adoption, then Wolf thinks people, you know, acknowledges people are worried that these organizations will ultimately be less productive. And I'm not sure that we can actually take the data that's available and make any inferences based on it, right? In that podcast episode that I mentioned earlier, Professor Malia Safri notes that the primary examples or the most common kinds of examples of worker cooperatives are in industries that are low capital intensive, meaning they don't require a massive investment in technology in order to have those, you know, to work in those industries, right? And so it might be that many of these studies are primarily focused on economic domains where Wolf's concern wouldn't apply. Now, there might be, obviously, there's a mountain of research that we haven't read everything in, and maybe there's answers to that. But at the very least, from what I've encountered so far, I'm not fully convinced that that's not a legitimate concern to have, that you know, move to worker cooperatives would have to deal with.
Yeah, so maybe we should say something about, so productivity aside, why aren't there more of these things? And you talked about some of the artificial barriers that arise. I don't know that it's this particular barrier is artificial, but one of the barriers that cooperatives and workplace democracies face is that they do have a harder time attracting investment or even getting loans from banks, right? Financing, basically. Why? Because if they're going to maintain their democratic decision-making, they can't have outsiders be, you know, partially in charge of the decision-making process as investors will want to be. So investors are less inclined to actually give co-ops money because they can't have that same amount of control, and so it's a riskier investment, et cetera. So part of, at least from what I've seen, a lot of people who advocate for worker co-ops also advocate for what are called shelter organizations, which are sort of like financing institutions specifically for co-ops and workplace democracies. And without those, then they're always going to be at a severe disadvantage in the long run.
Right, which explains, which goes hand in hand with the observation that these mostly exist in low capital intensive domains. And that, I think that's the obvious sort of explanation for the low percentage of them that exist, right? It makes sense that they would arise in things like industries like cleaning, right, where you don't have this massive upfront expense in technology to do that kind of work.
I should say, well, relatively speaking, there aren't many of them. There are still quite a few. And in fact, some examples off the top of my head, if you're into baking, there are actually multiple options for getting flour from worker co-ops. I think King Arthur Flour is a longtime worker co-op, as is, I think it's called Bob's Red Mill, which does a variety of flour and other baking-y things. I'm not an expert in baking. no, you should actually just Google search workplace democracies or worker co-ops, and you'll see some things that you recognize and be like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
And one of the, actually, I guess one of the interesting things is, like, you actually are seeing them arise in areas that are, like, it's not just, it might sound like, well, low capital intensive means, you know, sort of low skill or typical blue collar kind of work, right? There, it also means things like software development, right? There are worker co-ops in software development and other, you know, industries like that where there isn't as, you know, a major capital investment that's necessary to sort of get things up and running. So in some ways, like, the tech, I see the sort of tech revolution as opening the possibility, at least, that, you know, you will see, you could have worker co-ops that are more pervasive. It's just a question of incentives and why it is that you don't see more software development shops sort of opening up as worker co-ops.
We wouldn't be living in a system in which the key decisions corporations make are made by a tiny group of people, a board of directors, 15 to 20 people, usually selected by the major shareholders of a corporation, another group of 15 or 20 people. They decide, those tiny groups, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. And we live in an economic system that is the result of the decisions they make. And one of the first things that ought to occur to Americans is, if the pattern of outcomes from those kinds of decisions are as systematically dysfunctional as they have been and now are, that the minimum reasonable thing to do among the questions we ask as a people is, ought we to question and change the way we organize doing business?
So what about the epistemic properties of a worker co-op with respect to their decision-making? Is there any reason to think that they'll do better than an owner? right? Because you can imagine people, you know, who have a particular view of business saying like, no, the decisions should be left to the entrepreneurs and the business people who are the experts. And, you know, the person who is cleaning or making the hamburger or whatever, they're not qualified to make those kinds of decisions. And so they're just going to make bad business decisions. And that's a reason why they're not going to work.
So, yeah, when I have talked about worker co-ops and democracies with people outside of academia, this is the first and primary objection that you hear. And part of you hear it because they immediately imagine a completely flat structure. And they imagine that all of the decision processes are like, are really just what you would get if you had direct democracy without any kind of expert mediation at all.
Right.
Right. And that is not at all what the, you know, how the co-ops that were featured in the Edinburgh class function, right? They bring in consultants and experts in the industries that people work in. And those people are workers who have a vote. They have one vote, right? But they'll sort of say, I have the same vote as everybody else, but as an expert in this area, I end up having more influence than others because people recognize my expertise and I'm able to speak with a certain amount of expertise that other people don't have. And it's everybody's responsibility to listen to all the information that's available and defer to people who are, you know, to use a philosophy term, epistemic authorities. And there's nothing about the workplace democracy description that we've given so far that prohibits any of that kind of differentiation between voices on the board of directors or whatever.
And you might hope, too, that since in a workplace democracy or co-op, the worker will also be a stakeholder. So they might, you would hope, see that it's in their interest to be well-informed and to defer to experts when necessary. The other point, too, is like, there's a lot of dumbass entrepreneurs, right? A lot of dumbass business people. We shouldn't exaggerate the extent to which they are good at what they do.
No, well, right. So the other thing to observe, right, is that there's regularly a conflation between institutional authority and epistemic authority. That is to say, there's a regular conflation between being in charge of something and actually knowing what the fuck you're talking about.
Yep.
Then this actually comes up in the Edinburgh discussion, you know, interviews as well, is that there's an attempt by everybody to be transparent and to ensure that the information is widely disseminated and as reliable as possible. And at the end of the day, people recognize they have to defer to the people who are the authorities in various areas. Like, and this is actually something that comes up in Wolf's book that I thought was particularly interesting and where I was a bit skeptical of his view, where in some ways I agree, in some ways I don't. So he talks about how our educational system would have to evolve in order to accommodate worker democracies, right? And the kind of skills that would be prioritized in our education system if we lived in a state with full worker democracies would be very different from what you would prioritize under a capitalist system. And that seems 100% right. One of the things, though, that he suggests is that, like, what people could do is sort of switch roles regularly, and that by doing that, people could develop, you know, become well-rounded in how the business functions. And there, I think that's true for some kinds of jobs, but the reality is that for a lot of jobs, it requires an incredible investment of time and energy to develop the relevant sorts of expertise to be good at making decisions. Now, you can't rotate and have, you know, people who are software engineers become accountants and have your accountants become software engineers, right? Because it takes years and years of study for either subject to develop the technical expertise necessary to really understand and do well in that subject, right? So at least, you know, and so for a lot of different segments of companies, and most companies have both departments, right? They have a software department and they have an accounting department. Ultimately, the people outside of those departments have to defer to the expertise of the people who have the relevant kind of technical training, right? And that's just a general problem that we have in you know, society, right? When we're making political decisions, we have to trust the people who have developed the relevant kinds of expertise. And I think it's just the same kind of problem carries over to worker democracies.
Yeah, and with the point about having an educational system that would be better suited to having more of these workplace democracies, and obviously what Wolf's getting at right now is right now they are not set up at all in that way, right? And this also speaks to the kind of concerns about using the current data and extrapolating from it because of selection effects that might arise, right? It might be that it's really, maybe not always, but to a large degree, a very particular kind of person wants to get involved in cooperatives. Someone that's really self-directing, for instance, right, and expects and wants to have a high degree of autonomy in their work. Not everyone is like that, and not everyone is up for that, right? Some people, you know, as you've, you know, said to me anecdotally many times, some people just want the easy job, right? And they don't want to have to worry about any of the complications that come with, you know, taking more ownership of what they're doing or doing something more difficult. So I mean, just to take the stats on productivity, right? It could be that cooperatives are disproportionately made up of people who really want to have ownership of their work and really want to make their particular project work. But if you were to just sort of overnight transform a bunch of businesses into workplace democracies, you might not have the right kinds of people in who are the workforce, who make up the workforce right now, to make those work. It seems like ideally you want more of those people, right? And you'd like the educational system to produce more of those people. But you know, maybe this gets to the question of how practical it is or how able we are to implement these ideas now. But it does seem like this is a kind of a barrier. But maybe it is easy to change that. I don't know. Maybe people will go to co-ops for higher wages and they find that, shit, this is great. I don't know.
So the other like epistemic problem that we haven't talked about that I can see people worrying about is that as you flatten these things out, so like we're talking about, you know, having people defer to experts and being sort of reasonable in their judgment, right? I mean, the obvious question is, well, what about Dunning-Kruger?
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's this fundamental problem of the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Which is that, I mean, the really problematic component of it is that the lower a person's competence is, the more difficult it's going to be for them to recognize their own incompetence in a particular domain. And in the context of, you know, making business decisions, you really need people to actually defer to the experts. But what happens when people can't recognize their lack of expertise?
Right. Which they can't. They typically can't. If it were that easy, right, you wouldn't have the effect.
Right. And now the worry becomes, well, if we're going to be involving all of these people who haven't specialized in these various kinds of domains of decision making and really haven't specialized in them, then you're actually going to get more people who have votes who aren't particularly good at making judgments in those domains. And you might worry that you're not going to end up with better decision making as a result. That's kind of the elephant in the room, I think.
Yeah, and it's just tough to say, right? It's a question of, as you said, you know, can people recognize expertise? Can they be made to recognize expertise? Maybe they can, and then they defer. And of course, we should acknowledge too that when I think of Dunning-Kruger, I often think of, I have examples of business people that come to mind. So it's not as though, again, these people are immune by any means to this very phenomenon. But you might be concerned because business does require specialized knowledge that it would be more of a problem. Okay, so there's lots of questions about the economics of workplace democracies. On balance, there's some reasons to be optimistic. On a, you know, a wide scale, it's more difficult to say, and it's also difficult to say with respect to a wide, you know, with high capital investment kinds of and those kinds of fields. But as we've emphasized, one of the reasons why Wolf sees workplace democracy as a cure for capitalism is because of the effects on political life that he sees he's having. Because again, remember, he thinks one of the main problems with capitalism is that it undermines democracy. And that's bad. So it undermines the political autonomy of the vast majority of people. So then the question is, okay, why is it that having democracy in the workplace would revitalize political democracy? And I guess there's two major ways this happens. One is a reduction in economic inequality for some of the reasons that we've said. We would expect a more flat wage distribution, at least within an organization. Though as we stressed last in when we talked about this book previously, it's not like it's going to do away with inequality altogether. There still can be really quite massive inequalities in both income and wealth between different businesses, right? Depending on their profitability, depending on their field. And then also, you know, who has the skills and the experience to go into the more profitable fields, right? So there could still be, you know, racial inequality. It still could be the case that your family's wealth to a large degree predicts your economic outcome for all the same reasons that it does now.
It would be shocking if the elite educational institutions weren't still selecting, you know, for income as like one of the primary criteria, even if you switched over to a worker democracy society, right? Like, yeah, is Harvard really going to stop doing that?
And now I'm actually, you're making me start to worry about like a real kind of causal circularity here in Wolf's proposal, because what he's thinking is that, you know, what he could say in response to that as a solution is like, sure, but because the political situation will be different, even if not everyone can have a lucrative job, which they cannot, if there's more robust safety nets in place, then that will help mitigate some of the harms of inequality. And this is something, when we talked about inequality, we said one of the main harms isn't so much the disparity, though that is problematic, but the fact that people are actually living in poverty. So, you know, you could have a basic income or other kinds of measures to make sure that there isn't any kind of extreme poverty or anything like that. But that solution presupposes that the political situation has changed, which for Wolf presupposes that inequality has been dealt with to a large degree. I mean, maybe I'm getting ahead of us here, but now I'm a bit worried about this.
Yeah, I mean, to sum up, it's a kind of chicken and egg. It's an obvious kind of chicken and egg problem where each component of the revolution has to occur before the other one.
It works if workplace democracies could really flatten out inequality. But the problem is, like, you know, they could to an extent, right? We wouldn't see like crazy CEO pay, for instance.
No, but they're not going to – are they really going to – so, I mean, many of the inequalities that exist are not just financial inequalities, right? Like, sociologists regularly talk about the inequalities in cultural capital, right, as being part of the explanation for a lot of the different disparities in society. And they're not going to immediately change those, right? And a lot of the institutions that reinforce the inequalities, the financial inequalities, ultimately depend on those, on this inequalities of cultural capital, right? The fact is that people who come from educated families are much more likely to obtain elite higher education, which then means that they're likely to land, you know, well-paying positions. And the reality is that our elite educations are still going to select for those kinds of traits, regardless of whether or not our economic institutions are flattened out or not, at least until we have really equalized people's educational levels.
Right.
Which
and yeah, I think something you stressed last time, right? So if you cut down on like super astronomical CEO pay, maybe you bring down the top 0.1% or the top 1%, but there's still a massive difference between the top 20% and the bottom 80%, where a lot of these battles are sort of fought between those groups.
And that came up at the very in the very first couple of episodes we did, right, on the wealth gap, right, and the fact that the top 20% still actually do own a significant percentage of the overall wealth, whereas the bottom 20% literally don't own any.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we can come back to that, but that's an area of concern. Workplace democracy should help with inequality, but it takes a lot of help to actually make that no longer a problem. And it's not clear that workplace democracies can do all that work. Okay, so that was, I said, one of the ways in which Wolf thinks that workplace democracies can sort of help to revitalize political democracy. The other way has less to do with economics and more to do with the psychology of being in a workplace democracy. And I guess what he's doing is he's placing a bet that, or hypothesizing that, something like, you know, once workers get a taste of having this kind of control over their economic lives and, you know, being able to perform that kind of decision-making function, they will kind of naturally gravitate towards doing the same in the political realm. So you wouldn't see the kind of political apathy that we see now because they'll realize how great democracy is. Now that's a big bet to place.
It sure is. It's highly speculative, and I genuinely wonder, like, to what degree does this depend on assumptions about the educational system having already changed, right?
Uh-huh.
Because if we think about what it is like to participate in, or to be highly engaged and interested in democratic processes, we can look at the groups of people currently who are really engaged in political democracy and ask, well, has that actually improved people's intellectual engagement with each other, right? Has it improved rational discourse? Has it positively contributed to all of these important community values that he thinks that a worker democracy is going to restore? And there's obvious reason to be pretty skeptical about all of that, right? Like, is it the case? I mean, like, we're supposed to try to imagine how people's psychology will change when they engage in a certain kind of democratic process, when we already know that doesn't have that effect when they engage in another kind of democratic process.
Right. So just to be clear, I mean, what you're alluding to, and this is work that I think we'll be addressing in more detail in coming weeks and months. I can think of at least a couple of books that we'll probably talk about. But it's like this. Like, I would like to think, especially as a philosopher, I would love to think that if people were to sit down and talk about politics in a rigorous or sort of, you know, analytical way, they would learn from each other and they would, you know, come to better political beliefs or something like that. And in this, throughout this process, they'd become more civil to one another and respect each other more. I would love for all of those things to be true. But the empirical research suggests that the opposite is true, right?
What you end up with is an episode of Always Sunny.
Right. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Yeah, it seems that, in fact, when people engage in this, at least the deliberative process together, when they talk to one another about these things, and this could be for a variety of reasons, and perhaps it could be rectified, but at least on the surface, it makes people more polarized, more partisan, less respectful of one another. So it has the opposite effects. And again, this is something I think we'll talk about in the coming weeks, but so I think this was John Stuart Mill's hope, was that part of the value of democracy and having people engage in democratic processes that will increase their sort of emotional and intellectual virtues. It'll make them better people, smarter, etc. But it just seems like the opposite actually happens. So that's a big stick in the mud right there.
So what's interesting is we have already cited a lot of the positive evidence in favor of worker co-ops, right? And there people are actually engaging in these kinds of democratic processes within the workplace. And one of the interesting questions is, why is it that the effects seem to be so radically different in those contexts, right? And You know, there's potential reasons for optimism. Maybe it's about like the kind of personal engagement that is actually required for democracy. And that kind of engagement is not really what's going on when people are actually engaged in political processes right now. Right. So maybe there's reason for optimism. Or the other possibility is that there's something you're doing something fundamentally different when you're engaging in democracy at work.
At least in a couple of ways, that seems to be the case.
Right. You know, for one thing, you're really only trying, there is a fairly narrow kind of problem that you're trying to achieve consensus about, right? And it's one where if you've started by saying, look, we all have, you know, a bunch of things that we can all agree we'd like to maximize. We'd like to maximize the profitability that we are all going to collectively benefit from. If we want to maximize, you know, or to maximize our welfare and limit the amount of, you know, psychological and physical sacrifices that we need to make in order to obtain those profits, right? If you have that sort of very limited set of priority, and you know, you probably have other priorities too, like community values, and we'd like to make a positive contribution to the world and those kinds of things, but you have a fairly narrowly defined problem statement that you're trying to solve for. Whereas in the case of a democratic society, you have a much, much broader, more complex set of problems that you're trying to solve. And it seems, you know, there's just a question as to whether or not participation in that one kind of democratic process to solve that very narrow kind of problem is going to translate to this much broader, messier.
Right. So, you know, we're running a woodworking business, and there are tough questions to be faced concerning how to run the business. And business can be complicated, and there's lots of uncertainty. You need some expertise. However, what's more complicated and takes way more expertise is the incredibly difficult moral, political, sociological, cultural, economic questions that our major political decisions concern.
You know what's harder? Immigration.
Yeah, sure. And not only that, but, as we said before, you're not guaranteed, obviously, to have the business expertise you need to make good business decisions at your own business, right? If you're a woodworker at the business and you're great at, putting together sofas, it doesn't mean you're great at directing the business. But you're probably much closer. You're more likely to have relevant information there than you are to know about psychology and sociology. Which, by the way, it should be noted that it's not clear to me that even experts in these fields right now should feel very confident. I doubt that they do, because the problems that they deal with are so complicated that in many cases we just don't have the data. We just don't know, right? Or the theories to deal with it. Okay, so that's a major fundamental difference there. It's just the complexity and the level of expertise. The other thing, too, is, in the context of workplace democracy, especially if the business is small, your input can have a big effect on your own economic life, right? So if you screw up, if you make a bad vote at the workplace democracy, and there's only five of you there, that could be your Christmas bonus or something. And the political democracy in a massive country, I hate to say it, but your own vote isn't going to make much of a difference in your own life. So it's not like bad votes get penalized, at least for individuals. Now, interesting questions concerning what's going on right now and that phenomenon, but it's at least different, right? Because the amount of influence you have is so drastically different.
So there are a couple different differences in scale too, right? Where it's like, in some ways it's easier to actually engage in the political process in a worker democracy because the democracy is so small, right, that, and because the problem statement is so narrowly defined, than it is in a general democracy, a political democracy, where the problem statements are large and or in messy, and the collection is large enough so that the input you have is marginal, right? And then there's this incentive problem of, well, do you have incentive to actually develop the relevant expertise to actually be able to engage rationally in that decision-making process? In the case of a worker democracy, you might have that incentive. In a political democracy, you might not. But then, in addition to that, it's just there are all those epistemic barriers. One of the differences is that in a workplace, the kind of work that you do is typically pretty narrow, right? It's narrowly defined. If you work in an industry, what you have to do is develop expertise in that one narrow industry. Now, it's good to be well-rounded for lots of reasons to be sort of rational, but what you really need to make day-to-day decisions is expertise in your industry, right? And typically, actually, in your domain within that industry, in your specialization. And nothing like that translates for democracy. The kind of expertise you need are so wide-ranging that who could possibly hope to develop those?
Yeah.
So all these different dimensions come together to make it hard to imagine how it is, to see how this would actually work in the case of political democracies. Now, Wolf does actually talk about it as like community level organizing.
Right.
Right.
So you might be more optimistic about local political democracy, local politics than at the national level.
Right. But that is that where most of the major decisions that impact your life are made?
I think some say yes to that.
Okay.
It will depend, right? But I mean, here's another concern. In a workplace democracy, every worker has two jobs now. They have the job that they have to do, and then they also have the job of being informed and being involved in the decision-making process. Now, we did say there might be reasons for workers to cut down on their hours, but I think in research you've seen, it suggests that oftentimes they end up working more hours because they're more invested.
Yep.
Now, if that's the case, you got even less time for political democracy, because all of your democracy time is used on the workplace democracy, which, you know, is better than spending no time on democracy. And maybe it's, you know, if you have to choose one or the other, workplace democracy is probably a better use of your energies, unless you're engaged like in local politics, perhaps.
So part of me, there's an obvious sort of like flip side to this, right? Which is, so we're going to read, I suspect we'll read Jason Brennan's work against democracy at some point in the near future. There's a kind of flip side possibility to this, right? Which is, and then we'll read Bob Talese's work on sort of like the benefits of actually minimizing political engagement. Yeah. And there's kind of a funny flip side to this, which is maybe you're right, and maybe that's actually why democracy gets better.
Right? Because people have less time to spend on politics.
Yes, and so people just politics becomes less, you know, of a pervasive part of people's lives, which clearly makes most people fucking miserable because.
I have lots of questions and concerns about that. I mean, obviously, we don't want to get into it now, but that's certainly a possibility.
But it's certainly, I mean, it's worth just sort of emphasizing that is certainly not what Wolf is suggesting, right? He really thinks that it was going to lead to a major resurgence in political engagement, which is funny. There's like this, was there a period where people were, you know, deeply engaged in politics that was actually some GoldenEye ideal? Is resurgence the right term, or is it just...
Not in America.
Yeah.
I mean, because for most of the history, most people were disenfranchised anyways.
Right, and so... But even the people who were enfranchised, was there any period where they were highly informed?
Even if they were relative to their contemporaries, they had even less of a chance because the like sociological and economic knowledge just... was so much more primitive than it is now. I mean, they really were screwed.
Right.
I mean, we still are, but...
Right.
even if they were relatively engaged, it doesn't make them...
Better decision-makers.
...inform on the actual issues, yeah. Yeah, so this is tough. I mean, this is one of those things where I'd like to really feel good about it, right? I'd like to say, yeah, you know, workplace democracy will revitalize political democracy. And of course, it is a bit more complicated because he is seeing... Again, it's sometimes misleading because it sounds like he thinks workplace democracy is the thing that will sort of get everything else rolling. But more likely, it's more like workplace democracy is part of a larger movement, revolution, whatever, at the level of politics and political engagement, education, and these other really foundational kinds of things. And workplace democracy will be a really important part of that and will supplement these other kinds of movements. And that's a much less robust claim. It's a much weaker claim and thus more plausible, I think. And I think I'm amenable to that idea. Though even then, maybe not, right? Maybe workplace democracy takes away from democracy. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like,
it's tough.
Part of me, this is just another instance of my antisocial personality potentially just manifesting. Part of me is just like, I really don't want my workplace to become like my politics.
Yeah.
I don't know. I want to be optimistic about this. And probably the only way to really know is to actually run the experiment, right? Like,
yeah. But it's hard to even do that, right? Because, I mean, for a couple of reasons. And maybe this gets to the question of, like, how practical of a proposal is this? For one thing, without the changes in education, how far can we even get the thing started? And maybe we can. Probably there can be many more of these things than there are now. But then there's the other concern, right, which is inherent in Wolf's critique of capitalism, which is like, why would the capitalists be okay with this? And they have all the power now, right? And they can see the threat that these would pose to the order.
I don't even know that. So based on what we said earlier, I don't even know that the capitalist even has to be worried. Right. All the capitalist has to do is not play along, because
right. All
of the industries that have a significant capital investment requirement just for initial entry into the marketplace aren't going to have worker co-ops unless somehow capital decides to shoot itself in the foot. Right. So the question, you know, like you can organize around seizing capital. But short of that kind of political revolution for at least a massive number of industries, it's hard to even begin to foresee why capitalism would play along at all.
Yeah.
So, and that this I think raises one of the other questions. You know, so you pose it as like, is this feasible, right? And it depends on what you define as the goal. If it is to encourage worker cooperatives in contexts where they naturally could arise and succeed, then it seems like, yeah, it's an achievable goal. But then the question becomes, well, does it then have these major political implications that Wolf cites? And I think the answer is clearly no, right? Because as long as you have a significant amount of capital in place and the economic mechanisms that capital uses to influence and manipulate our politics are still available to them, he has all the reasons to think that they're going to continue to use them, right? And the mere existence of worker democracies doesn't disarm the capitalist class and strip away all those mechanisms. And then you say, okay, well, then the goal, in order to actually really, save democracy, you can't just have partial, increases in worker co-ops and whatnot, but you actually require the economy to be fully transformed into nothing but. And then you have to wonder, well, how on earth would we get there? Right. Again, because unless capital shoots itself in the foot, where's the capital coming from for all of the capital intensive industries?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the end, the weak claim remains plausible, perhaps, or at least the most plausible, that a kind of successful reorganization of political and economic life could and perhaps would include a predominance or a massive increase in workplace democracies. The stronger claim, or the extremely strong claim, that having workplace democracies will solve all of the problems, which she's not committed to that view, obviously, that's implausible. And it's not even the weaker, but still somewhat strong claim that, like, this is the place to start to get all of these other balls rolling. That might also not be true. In the end, I don't know what his thesis ends up being, and it doesn't really matter for our purposes. Just Wolf interpretation.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I would like to just go on the record and say I really like the idea of workplace democracy. I have for a long time. It's really interesting. And, you know, it's one of those things that is really largely underexplored. And it would be interesting if, you know, if these were, you know, what do things look like if co-ops are much more prominent at, say, business schools? We might learn much more about them. They might get better. There might be new forms of organization that are developed. Or maybe that's just antithetical to the business school ethic. I don't know.
It's hard for me to not say super cynical things here.
Yeah.
I like the idea. So I should take back in some ways my earlier comment about how I'm cynical about having to work at a worker democracy, you know, worker co-op or whatever. I like the idea of workplace democracies, but as long as the caveat that you noted a long time ago in this conversation, which probably at this point will be last episode, which is that I would like to be able to opt out of the democratic participation in them. Right. What I wouldn't want is to be in a workplace where I was constantly required to attend meetings to participate in democratic decision processes for a company. I would much more would enjoy a role, you know, building something or working on something.
And I don't think that you would necessarily need to be, right? Because they don't have to all be the kind of direct democracy model. In fact, for some of them, it is a representative democracy model, right? So you can people basically vote on someone or a group of people to form a kind of board to coordinate and make those kinds of decisions temporarily, then you have another election, et cetera, et cetera, in the way we're familiar with. So don't worry, Michael, we can make a workplace democracy that works for you.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess the upshot here is I think for a lot of people that are very unfamiliar with the idea, the tendency is to dismiss them on economic grounds or grounds that really aren't well supported. These things can and do work. And probably we could have many more of them, and it's an interesting and open question as to whether we develop the institutions to make them more competitive in the long run and have more investment and things like that. Where we have concerns or questions, I mean, there's just questions because this is all a lot of speculation, which is sort of necessary given the state of our information. Where we have those concerns is with respect to how transformative these would be of our political and economic lives. But anyways, man, we should probably shut up about these things.
At least for this week.
This is what happens if we miss 2 weeks, right? You just gotta have this sort of verbal dump. I guess.
This purge that you have to
yeah.
do.
Yeah. We just can't get enough of our own voices or something like that. No, actually, it's just me because I do the editing. So I have to hear us twice.
Thank God.
It's brutal. Anyways, how about we wrap it up there? Your cat is now sitting on your shoulder saying, "Where the F is my dinner?"
He sure is.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.